T.H.L. Parker began his first little biography of Calvin. He's subsequently written another one, which was available on the bookstall in paperback. But he began his first little biography with these words. A new clerical acquaintance and I were talking of John Knox. He was reminded of John Calvin. Calvin now, he said. He was terrible. Terrible? I asked. How? I mean Calvin, he said. You know about Calvin, don't you? He plainly thought I had not caught the name. Calvin was terrible. No one, surely, who called himself a loyal Anglican could dissent from the verdict that Calvin was terrible. But why terrible, I asked. He found the question difficult. It was axiomatic that Calvin was terrible, but in what way it was not easy to say, especially if one knew of him only by hearsay. But he was a strong-minded man and refused to be beaten. He was terrible, he replied firmly. And then with inspiration, I mean, look how bad-tempered he was. Then there was another man in a different class where Romans chapter 3 was being expounded. The teaching of the Roman Catholic Council of Trent was mentioned, and also that of Luther and Calvin. He interrupted me at the name. Calvin, he said. He was all on about predestination, wasn't he? Bad temper and predestination. A gruesome picture, certainly, but rather too bad to be true. Nobody could be quite so bad as that, surely. Well, I think Parker's introduction still serves as a reminder to us that however familiar we are with the name of Calvin, at least with the name being quoted with some reverence and respect, it's true that the very name Calvin is probably one of the most pejorative names that's around. You know, the word Calvinist or Calvin is fairly widely used or quoted in you know, the secular world and even the religious world, and almost always with bad connotations. You know, I used to know people in the Highlands who never came near church and wouldn't know one end of anything approaching a theology book for another, but they were quite happy to stand propping up the bar in the hotel and blaming all the ills of Scotland on Calvin and the Calvinists. Calvin has a bad reputation. The very strength of his negative reputation is a tribute to the man's greatness. Whether you like Calvin or not, agree with him or not, you're forced, unless out of sheer ignorance, you're forced to admit that he is one of the most influential men who have ever lived. It was Calvin's teaching that was followed by, for instance, the Dutch people in that great rebellion against Spain that was one of the most significant events at the end of the 16th century and did much to break the Spanish Empire. Even more significantly, it was Calvin and his teaching who lay behind the English Puritans and the Scottish Covenanters and their great struggles with absolute monarchy, which did so much to give us parliamentary democracy. All the early pilgrims and Puritans who went to America were Calvinists, and the New World was begun out of Calvinist motives and on Calvinist principles. Those great nations which did so much in the age of colonialism and expansion, Holland, Britain, and the United States of America, were all profoundly influenced by Calvinism. We may not agree with is it Tawney's theory on the religion and the rise of capitalism in its sort of thoroughgoing way, but we have to recognize that the nations that became the leading nations in growing capitalism and industrialism were largely influenced by Calvinism. Science, art, education, politics, a whole range of human thinking and activity has been profoundly influenced by this man. So Calvin deserves to be studied simply if we're to be educated human beings living especially in Europe in the 20th century. But as Christians, not only will we be especially interested in many aspects of that history, but we have to recognize that Calvin's name is rightly linked, as Parker's quote mentioned, with some of the most important and practical and difficult doctrines of the Bible. The doctrines of election and predestination may often have been distorted. They may cause still fierce debate, but we who believe in them recognize their importance and their power to influence our lives. And we cannot but be interested in a man who did so much to clarify the church's understanding of them. Even more to the point, I think, is the fact that Calvin, even more than being the theologian of predestination, was the theologian of the Holy Spirit. It was Calvin's great teaching, or great achievement, to bring out for the first time the role of the Holy Spirit in the regeneration, in the what we would call the effectual calling of the sinner to grace. And today, when the doctrine of the Holy Spirit is so confused, Calvin is a mighty figure and a wrongly neglected one. He ought to be much more studied with regard to the Holy Spirit. And, of course, as Presbyterians, or many of us are Presbyterians, we look back to Calvin as the one who developed and organized the church and its disciplined life, which we seek to express today. Well, for all those reasons, Calvin demands to be studied. I was going to ask you this, but I forgot to do that. How many of you have actually read A Life of Calvin? Which one? Yeah, you don't remember which one? Yeah. Anybody else?
Half.
Which one's that? Oh, that is the... yes, that is the Parker one. That's the one I mentioned, yes.
Okay. Mahasma. That's another book.
Oh, right. Is that in English or Spanish?
Spanish.
Right. There are various... Years ago, you may still come across it. Somewhere. I don't know if it's been reprinted. The IVP did it. You can tell how old it is. It's one of those early paperbacks that still had a loose cover. But it was a book called The Man God Mastered by Jean Cadier, a Frenchman. It's in English. There's another one that James Clark did a few years ago by a man called Emmanuel Stickelberger. It's got the same picture, I think, on the cover. There's this one by Parker, which is now in paperback. I'm not sure if there's one still on the bookstore. Perhaps it's gone now. But that's available in paperback still, and is a very good one. Various other books. This book on Calvin's life and thought. Most of the book concerns Calvin's teaching, but it does have a short section at the beginning of biographical teaching. That's published by Fontana. Not sure if it's still in print. It's very useful. Wendell isn't, he would disagree with Calvin, and to some extent he distorts Calvin's teaching on predestination. Mainly, though, I think he reflects what Calvin says but disagrees with him. But it's a very helpful study of Calvin's life as well. Going back a bit further, there's Williston Walker's biography. That was reprinted a few years ago. There's loads of books on Calvin, so you've got no excuse, really. You all ought to read them. But anyway, after this marvellous study, you won't need to read anything else. But just to make you feel guilty before we start. Let's put this here. Okay, well, what I want to do is to... I discovered, by the way, that we got 3 weeks on this subject, not just 2, which is good, really, because what I've roughly done is to divide Calvin's life into 2 parts, which I want to cover, first part this week, second part next week, and then the 3rd week to try and very quickly give a sort of bird's eye view of Calvin's influence geographically in different countries and in the course of history, different areas of human thinking and life. Did you know, for instance, that Calvin had great influence in Poland and Lithuania? That Calvin had great influence in Hungary, as well as in Scotland and, you know, more familiar places. We'll try and look at that the third week. Tonight, though, I want to look at the story of Calvin up to the year 1541. I think that's about the first 32 years of his life, until the time when he finally settled in Geneva. His return to Geneva. He was there for a while, as we'll see, and was expelled. Then finally, in 1541, he went back there, and he stayed there for the rest of his life. It's unfortunate, in a way, that this first part of his life, with its dramatic movements from one place to another, tends to occupy the lion's share of his biographies. It's a bit like sort of you know, Henry IV, part one and part two. You know, and a lot of people know half the play and, well, the rest is just glossed over. Or the story, Cinderella story, you know, that's all about how Cinderella met the prince, and then it writes off the rest of their lives by saying they lived happily ever after. In fact, it's the rather less exciting rest of Calvin's life from 1541 for the next 25 years or so that had the greatest influence. But nonetheless, those first years of his life, through his education, his conversion, his exile, and until he finally settled in Geneva as leader of the church there, it's those that did so much to form the man. And we can only begin to understand his achievement and his emphases when we know a bit more about his background. Now, by the wonders of modern science, you have maps and so on reduced to a size that makes it impossible for normal-sighted human beings to read the things. But anyway, they're there on the sheets. Calvin was born at Noyon. I'm not sure that's the right. Who's a French linguist? Anybody a French linguist? That's all right. You won't know any wise. Noyon is this town up here in Picardy, very close to the River Somme and some of the battlefields of the First World War. But Calvin was born there in 1509. His father was really a man on the rise. He'd got some education and he'd moved to Noyon and got himself a sort of civil service post with the local council and, because the two really were interwoven, with the local bishop. He was a sort of episcopal officer. He had some legal training and administrative training. Probably because of his position with the bishop, though he was only really a petty bourgeoisie himself, his son was friendly with the bishop's family and bishop's relatives, the family Hengist. And from his earliest days, Calvin had friends among wealthy, fairly powerful people. He naturally seemed to mix in those sort of circles. He showed early promise in education. That's what devout biographies say when they mean he was a real creep at school. You know, used to work and come top and everything. But he obviously did excel in his studies from an early age. And it's a fascinating thing that he had two brothers. And one little reference we have, I think, to his brother Charles, says that, you know, he didn't show any particular promise and expertise at his studies. And, you know, in a word, he was thick. And it's amazing, isn't it, that in the same family, the same background, you get one person who's an absolute genius, as Calvin was, you know, academically speaking, intellectually, and a brother with all the same background and parents and everything, and yet who's just an ordinary, rather dull mortal being. Anyway, Calvin, at an early age, went to Paris. Used to be asserted that he went there in 1523. Certainly he did travel to Paris in 1523. Parker argues that he probably went there earlier than that, perhaps as early as 1520, when he was just 11 years old. strange to our ears, but probably not in those days, Calvin's education was financed by being appointed to the benefice, to a church. He was appointed to be chaplain of a church in Lyon, later of a church in Paris, which meant he got the priest's salary. He never actually went there and did anything, but that money financed him studying at university. That was, of course, a very common part of medieval life. It was one of the big complaints of the reformers in practice about absentee priests. But there we are, it was generally accepted, and young Calvin went to study in Paris, helped by that chaplaincy. He was aimed for the priesthood by his father. He studied at the University of Paris, which was, I think, the most ancient of the medieval universities. He was in various colleges, including the Sorbonne, and one called the College de Montaigu, which was notorious for its extremely strict and severe disciplinary regime. The boys got up at 5 o'clock in the morning and worked till 8 o'clock at night. There was very severe punishment for any disobedience and so on. And the food provided was very poor. Like several other great men in the past, it seems likely that Calvin suffered for the rest of his life as a result of the bad diet and the overlong hours of study that he engaged in at that time. Complaints which, for one reason or another, we're not familiar with today. At that college, Erasmus had himself studied previously, and by one of those strange quirks of history, just as Calvin was leaving that college, Ignatius Loyola, who was to found the Jesuits, he came there to study. Calvin, as I said, was a very bright scholar who excelled in all his studies. Sometimes the impression is given that he was a thoroughly, you know, loathsome and negative sort of being. There's a story that's often told that Calvin had a nickname when he was at college, and he was called the Accusative Case. But one of Calvin's French biographers very thoroughly went into all those sort of, you know, derogatory stories about Calvin. And he found that this story was first put about in 1600 and something. And in fact, there's no evidence for it at all in the time of Calvin or from those who knew him personally. Calvin had a cousin called Olivetin. That was his nickname anyway. And he was, by the way, Olivetin is a reference to the oil, olives oil. And this French boy was given the nickname Olive Oil or Olivetin because he stayed up so late studying. He was always burning the midnight oil. But this Olivetin was also known as the ablative case, I think because he always made a great show of taking off his coat. And if you know Latin, which better than I do, you know that ablative would be the case that you'd use for taking something off. That's the part of speech you use. And Calvin was someone who was ready to speak up for what he felt was right. But that sort of slander and distortion and half-truth of history, so often used by Calvin's opponents in later biographies of him, does mean that one should be very careful of many of the stories and sayings that you hear about Calvin. There are loads of them floating around, and don't feel obliged to accept as gospel truths, you know, sort of slanderous sayings or stories that people quote. Not that, you know, we're not arguing that Calvin's perfect, but as someone who was bitterly hated, especially by Roman Catholics, there were produced in the 17th century, about 100 years after Calvin's life, several completely malicious purported biographies of him. They really tried to do a hatchet job on Calvin's life, you know, sort of son expose, or news of the world expose, that bears no relation to the truth at all. And so many of the derogatory things that are said of Calvin are drawn indirectly or directly from those Catholic publications. Anyway, during that time, Calvin undoubtedly came under the teaching of what is known as scholasticism, that highly developed medieval theology of the Roman Catholic Church. One of his teachers was a man called John Mayer, who was a leading scholastic and who wrote a book refuting Luther's teaching. And we can be sure that Calvin, as a student in Paris, was made familiar with Luther's teaching, but we have his own word for it. You have the extracts there on the sheet. We'll look at them in more detail in a bit. That he rejected that teaching. At this stage of his life, it's clear that as far as his religious views went, he was an adherent of the Roman Catholic Church. But about this time, a change came in his life because his father got involved in a big dispute with the church. It's not clear why. Maybe his father had been fiddling the books, but anyway, there was a big dispute, and eventually his father was excommunicated by the church in Noyon. At that time, the father decided he didn't particularly want his son to be a priest and thought there was more mileage in his being a lawyer. And so he commanded his son to change to being a lawyer. And Calvin reluctantly obeyed his father. He left Paris and went to Orléans in 1528, not far to the southwest of Paris. There he studied law in an atmosphere that was very different. Paris was a very traditional university, very much steeped in medieval Roman Catholic theology. It was a centre of reaction, whereas Orléans was much more a centre of the new humanism, that is, the study of the classics, Latin and Greek, and a questioning of all medieval values. Calvin studied law in Orléans for about a year. Then in 1529, he moved further south still to Bourges, where there was a famous law teacher at work, and Calvin studied under him. He also there met a Lutheran, the first individual Lutheran that we know of his meeting, a man called Vollmar, who taught him Greek. And but still, there's no indication that Calvin accepted his religious views. 1531, Calvin's father died, and he returned to Paris, a free agent, no longer bound by his father's wishes. He enrolled in a new college that had been founded there that was definitely humanist. That is, by humanist, I don't mean our sort of anti-Christian humanist, but humanist in the medieval sense of being devoted with the rediscovery of classical learning, studying Aristotle and Plato and the writers of the ancient world, learning the original languages, Latin, Greek, of course, so Latin had always been known, but learning Greek. About this time, Calvin began to learn Hebrew as well. He was more concerned, as Wendell puts it at this time, though, for the re-establishment of good literature. That was far more important than attacking Roman dogmatics. There's no sign of conversion, spirituality in the man, but we can recognize that God in his providence was giving Calvin a wide-ranging education that would equip him for the many different tasks that lay before him. He has had an education, the best available in his country. He has learnt and studied medieval theology. He has learnt Greek and is beginning to learn Hebrew. He's also had some years studying law and the argumentation, the clear logical thinking, the presentation of a case that a lawyer needs. And it's interesting, by the way, how many of the great men of church history had law training as part of their course. Augustine, the other great example, I suppose, of a man who was trained as a lawyer, then converted, became a great theologian. Calvin had that wide-ranging education. And though at the moment there's no grace, we can see the way that God is equipping him for what lay ahead. The other point I did want to make there is that while Calvin was a great student, he's not to be thought of as a miserable, you know, sort of objectionable person. It's interesting that the first teacher of Latin that he had, a man called Cordier, so a lot, he was about 30 years older than Calvin. He was one of the greatest Latin teachers of the time. And he taught Calvin when Calvin was in his first year in the college in Paris. And yet Cordier became a friend of Calvin. And years later, when Calvin in Geneva was setting up his school and college there, Cordier came from Paris to organize the school there and to teach Latin in the school in Geneva. He came to be with Calvin. And I think that says a great deal about not just the academic ability, but the personality of this young man. He made friends with many people, and he had good and close friends in Paris in those days. Obviously, he was a remarkable and an altogether unusual person in his academic application, in his seriousness, and so on. But we mustn't think of him as a totally two-dimensional, unsociable person. He was a man of great feeling and great personal concerns. Well, very little is known about Calvin's conversion, except that it almost certainly took place in the year 1533. He's back in Paris, and at that time there was an increasing influence in Paris, what we would call reformist influence. That's what the historians call it. It was a man called Jacques Lefebvre, who was the leading preacher of this group. They were people who had accepted much of evangelical biblical doctrine and recognized the importance of many of the things that Luther had said. But they were reformist rather than reformers, in the sense that they were very reluctant to break with the Roman Catholic Church. And they really wanted just to be left alone to preach their thing within the Roman Catholic Church. They didn't, in other words, go to the root of the tree. They said many good things. They criticized many errors and abuses in Rome, but they seem to have lacked that thoroughgoingness, that boldness that characterized a Luther or a Calvin, and which really brought about effective and lasting change. Now, round about 1533, Lefebvre was preaching openly in Paris with the approval of the king. And many of those who followed him and shared his beliefs were confident that within a few years, the king himself would accept their evangelical views and would change the French church from the top. The French church was very much under royal power. Calvin doesn't tell us much about his conversion. We know a lot less about Calvin's personal history than we do about Luther's. I think that reflects the sort of self-effacingness of the man and the humility of the man. What we do have are those two extracts. You have them on the first page and over on the second page. The first one comes, I think, from his commentary on the Psalms. This is in the preface. He tells how he was obstinately devoted to the superstitions of the papacy and was stubbornly in opposition to the truth, the gospel. But he tells us that God, just this sentence about seven or eight lines down there, then God, by a sudden conversion, changed and shaped my heart towards being more receptive. And simply, that's all we know directly about Calvin's conversion. It's an intriguing statement, because it does describe a sudden conversion. And we would love to know more detail. There's all sorts of speculation on just how that came about. Say the most we can do by process of elimination is to say that, well, it was probably in 1533 that it took place. Calvin then goes on to say that having been converted, he was stirred with great enthusiasm and pursued the study of this new faith with all the thoroughness that he had given to his studies of law and humanism. I should have added that in 1532 he'd published his first book, which was a commentary on the book of Seneca on clemency. It was a commentary on an old Roman Latin work, a book by a pagan on the virtue of clemency. Calvin shows no biblical or Christian distinctive in writing that book, but he published this book with the hope of making his name as a humanist scholar, and was rather mortified that the book hardly sold at all. Now, of course, it's quite famous and the subject of all sorts of learned studies because of what Calvin became afterwards. But he applied himself to this study, and he tells us that very quickly he became someone who was much in demand as a teacher and a leader, that he faces up quite honestly to his own shyness, preferring tranquility and repose. The other extract, just over the page, was written in a letter or a treatise that he wrote against a Roman Catholic called Cardinal Sadoleto, who had written trying to persuade the people of Geneva to return to Rome. Calvin dealt with his arguments, but in the course of that, he gives this rather personal account of his own conversion. The more closely I examined myself, the sharper became the stings of conscience. He again says how he was offended when he first met Protestantism with its claim to go back to the roots of Christian teaching. He allowed himself to be instructed by them. Interestingly, he tells us here that one of his objections to Protestant teaching was the idea that it somehow discredited or devalued the church. Of course, Roman Catholic theology always gave great veneration to the church. But Calvin tells us that one part of his conversion was in understanding that evangelical, biblical Protestantism doesn't devalue the church, but rather clears the church from all the contamination and confusion of Roman Catholic thinking. Well, Calvin was now a Christian. He moved in a growing circle of evangelical Christian people in Paris. As I say, they had high hopes there in 1533 the king would adopt reforming ways and views. But I think at the end of 1533, a crisis occurred. Whether wisely or unwisely, Calvin's friend Nicholas Kopp, the son of the king's surgeon, was being inducted as professor in one of the colleges. And in his inaugural address, he chose to make a public statement of his evangelical faith, drawn in part from Luther's sermons, and largely an attack upon the old medieval theology of the Sorbonne. I don't think the public took much notice, and I don't think the king would have taken much notice, but of course the learned professors of the Sorbonne were very sore indeed, and not very bon. So they raised a real stink about heresy, and Kopp was forced to flee. Calvin was implicated. It's one of these, one of these things you could do a PhD on and the world would be none the richer. But there's great debate as to whether Calvin wrote Kopp's speech or not. Certainly, though, Calvin was so closely connected with Cop that he came under suspicion, and he fled out the back door when the police came to the front door to arrest and interrogate him. For a while through 1534, Calvin stayed in different parts of France. You have to remember, if you know your secular history of this time, that, you know, states, especially like France, while they had a king, they were a long way from being centralized states. While the king in some respects had absolute power, local magnates, local rulers had a great deal of autonomy, and it all depended which part of the country you were in. Calvin was various places, down at Angoulême and different parts. I think he was in Orléans again for a while here, and met up with fellow believers in Protestant truth. In Orléans, it's interesting that he met with people and celebrated the Lord's Supper with them in a Protestant way. He is now making a clear break with Roman Catholicism. At this time, he visited Noyon and resigned those benefices that had been financing his studies. It's interesting. I think Walker has some detail. At one point, Calvin was arrested in Noyon because of a disturbance in the cathedral. Just what this was about, we don't know. And it's intriguing that for several days he was imprisoned in Noyon before he was let out. But this sort of, you know, semi-legal, semi-illegal life, he wasn't actually an outlaw. He was just afraid that, well, Paris was perhaps too hot for him, so he'd better, you know, move around. Sometimes he used a pseudonym to cover his tracks, but, you know, he could go on in that sort of way. But the end of 1534, there was a famous affair of the placards. Some very keen Protestants, maybe lacking in wisdom, as keen Protestants often do, published and produced some posters setting out Protestant truth in no uncertain terms and setting out Roman Catholic error in even less uncertain terms. And these posters were printed, and one night at the end of 1534, they were placarded, they were fly-posted, I suppose we would say, all over Paris, all over the royal palace. Somebody even stuck one up in the king's bedchamber. And, of course, there was a tremendous row, and the king was stirred to act against the Protestants. Many of Calvin's old friends in Paris were arrested and burnt at the stake. And there was such a general persecution at that time that it became necessary for Calvin and many like him to flee the country. So Calvin, with no small difficulty, all his money was taken by a dishonest servant along the way. But eventually Calvin fled the country. Well, that takes us down to number three on the sheet. He passed through Strasbourg. Strasbourg at that time wasn't in France. Sort of Alsace-Lorraine were part of the that loose thing, what we call the Holy Roman Empire. Passed through Strasbourg, came down here to Bâle, on the border between Germany and Switzerland. Bâle was a great centre of learning. Erasmus had lived in Bâle, and there were reformers in Bâle. That man whose name I'm sure is often on your lips, Oecolampadius, was the great leading reformer of Bâle. You'll know Oecolampadius. You should do. My cat is named after Oecolampadius, but we decided that Oecolampadius was rather too long a name for the cat. But I'd just been reading about him when we got the cat. But dear, that's on tape for posterity. Never mind. Anyway, Calvin landed in Bâle, and Calvin's ideal, as perhaps you can imagine, was that, well, you know, he'd been involved with Christians in France, he'd been exiled, but, well, never mind. As an exile, he'd got his books, and there were plenty of books in Bâle, and he could spend his life doing what he loved doing, most of all as a fairly shy, retiring, scholarly young man. He could read and study. He could learn Hebrew properly, and he could write books. And that was Calvin's idea of bliss. So he stayed in Bâle, and he wrote his book, a little book, that was called The Institutes of the Christian Religion, published in Bâle in March 1536. You have an English translation and sort of imitation of the title page there on the sheet. Embracing almost the whole sum of piety and whatever is necessary to know the doctrine of salvation. A work most worthy to be read by all persons zealous for piety, recently published. If you're familiar with the massive institutes and the two volumes, you've got to realize that this wasn't that book. It was almost the skeleton of it, but even this gives a wrong impression. This is an English edition of that first edition of the Institutes, but most of this book, in fact, is taken up with notes. And anyway, it's a sort of typewritten facsimile, but the whole of the Institutes is in those pages there. And, you know, if that were properly printed out like the other one, it would be, you know, compared to the massive Institutes that we know, it was like a small paperback. It really, despite the claims of its title to embrace the whole sum of piety, it really was an exposition of the Apostles' Creed and the Ten Commandments from a Protestant viewpoint. The second edition had the title, Now at Last, Doing What Its Title Says, when he much expanded it a few years later. Well, it was certainly a little book, but it wasn't insignificant. It was a careful and detailed statement of the faith of the French Protestants. You've got the preface there that Calvin, or part of the preface there that Calvin attached to the book. And that preface was addressed to the French king. You see, Francis I was in alliance with Lutheran princes in Germany in his frequent battles with the German emperor, Charles V, the Catholic emperor. And Francis of France was in this strange position that he was allied to Lutheran princes, but he was burning French Protestants at the stake. And his answer to the Lutherans and his public statement was, well, of course, these people in France, they're not like you Lutherans. These people are anarchists. These people are fanatics. These people are extremists. And you Lutherans aren't very tolerant of extremists. You Lutherans punish fanatics. Well, that's what I'm doing in France. And Calvin wrote the Institutes and addressed it to Francis to say, look, we're not fanatics. We are not extremists. We're not anarchists. This is what we believe. And it was, in that sense, a defense of these persecuted French Protestants in showing that they believe the biblical truth, the Apostles' Creed, the Lord's Prayer, and so on. He deals with it in no uncertain terms with the allegations of the Roman Catholics that this doctrine was false because it was new. And Calvin waxes with his lawyer's sarcasm. He says, well, of course, to these Roman Catholics, it is new teaching. But then the teaching of the Bible is new to these people because they've never read the Bible and they don't know the Bible. And he claims, in fact, not only that Protestant teaching is not fanatical and extreme and anarchistic, he claims that Protestantism is the Christian truth. It is the true church, or the truth of the real church. And he defends Protestantism with this statement. Well, we're not sure that the book had any impact or positive impact on Francis I. But although it was addressed to him and aimed partly for that purpose, it became immediately useful as a handbook for new Christians. Now, you know, I think many of us can appreciate the value of that book when, you know, how many times we say, I have people coming to me and saying, you know, have you got a book that, that sets out our faith sort of simply and basically? We've got a friend who's very interested, or a friend who's just converted, and you know they've got no background at all. Have you got a book that makes it all simple and clear? We're always looking for that, that sort of magical book, and somehow or another we never quite have just the one to hand. But it's a sort of thing that we often want. And now imagine yourself back to the Reformation days, where after all these centuries have died, there aren't any good books to be reprinted because people haven't written them. Luther, for all the books he churned out, and he kept something like 5 printing presses going non-stop, didn't produce a sort of overall theology, you know, a handbook of all Christian doctrine. Zwingli, the reformer of Zurich, had produced a small little book that went some of the way there. But Calvin's book was the first sort of systematic A to Z of Protestant doctrine. And it was immediately, in all of French-speaking parts, it was immediately recognized as a most valuable and useful help to those new churches. Calvin became famous very quickly in Protestant circles through that little book that he published. Probably by the time it was published, Calvin had already left Bâle. He'd gone on in his wandering scholar's life to the little duchy of Ferrara, which was down here, I think on the coast, but probably in that area just below Venice in Italy. The Duchess of Ferrara was a French princess, daughter of a previous French king. And she was very sympathetic to this evangelical movement in France. And she gathered around her a number of French evangelicals, we'd call them, I suppose. Her husband was not at all sympathetic, and indeed he soon had them expelled or made Ferrara too hot for them. But for a while, Calvin went to Ferrara and taught there and moved in that circle of exiles. Again, it's interesting that the Duchess of Ferrara remained a firm friend of Calvin throughout his life. He wrote to her, she wrote to him. When her husband died, she moved back to France and she joined the Huguenots, the French Protestant church, and supported them and was involved with them in all their struggles. April 1536, Calvin was back in France. Things had eased a little bit, and he came to transact some family business, but he didn't stay long. Probably he realized that there was no future for him in France, and he set out to come back from Noyon, Paris, to Bâle. Now, the straightest way, the most natural way, would have been to go down through Strasbourg and straight to Bâle. But there was a war on between the emperor and the French king. And in this region, there were armies on the move. And so Calvin had to get to, or tried to get from Paris, northern France, to Bâle, not going that way, but coming right the way around here on a detour. And so it was that one night he stopped on his journey in this city of Geneva. You have the extract there on the third page, the famous description of that, where he said he decided to go quickly via Geneva, not intending to spend longer than a single night in the city. But when he was there, somebody got to know who he was. He was the author of this book, The Institutes. And then this man, Farrell, a fiery preacher, if ever there was. In fact, it was Farrell who was behind the placards that were posted in the king's bedchamber and so on. Farrell had been the means, with another preacher, of bringing Geneva to accept Protestantism. He was a real, Farrell was a real open-air preacher. Stand up on a tub and shout down the opposition, and, a real fiery Fred sort of preacher. But Farrell knew that he wasn't a good organizer. He wasn't a good developer of the church. And it seemed to Farrell that the answer to his prayers had arrived on his doorstep. This young man who had written this so clear statement of Christian teaching was exactly what was needed in Geneva to develop the new church. And so he threatened Calvin, said, "Oh no, I don't want to. I'm not fitted for this work. I just want to live a quiet life and write books and be a student." And Farrell said to him in as many words, "God will curse your studies if you refuse to stay here." And Calvin, who was a very sensitive person, was awed by Farrell's threats against him, or Farrell's curse on him. And so he agreed to stay in Geneva. Farrell did let him just go to Bâle to get his books, or to get some books, and then he was back in Geneva. Calvin wouldn't accept a permanent position. He was just sort of installed as a reader in the cathedral in Geneva. So began his first stay in Geneva that lasted for just 2 years. I must be quick here. Geneva, as you'll see by the picture there on that third page, was really a very small town. Its population in 1536 was only about 10,000 people, which is really a pretty small town. It had only recently established its independence from Savoy. The lands of the Duke of Savoy almost surrounded Geneva. In that sort of great social upheaval of the late Middle Ages, the town was asserting its independence. And surely, certainly, there were as many political as there were religious motives in its acceptance of Protestantism. For the bishop in Savoy had great political power, and in becoming Protestants, they were politically throwing off the control of the bishop. There remained, though, a strong Catholic movement in Geneva, and many of those who had professed Protestantism did so without any spiritual concerns, only out of political motives. Farrell realized how fragile that new church was, and he wanted Calvin to organize things. Calvin tried to do that, and stirred up a hornet's nest. It focused upon the fact that not only did they organize regular Protestant teaching and preaching in the churches, but they sought to establish a disciplined church life. That is, while they didn't look to create a sort of little separatist church within believer in Geneva, just gathering together a few believers in a private fellowship. No, his idea was the Church of Geneva, all the people professing religion in that church. Yet he also insisted that there be right discipline, that the Lord's Supper, for instance, be only administered to those who had been examined by their pastors, and who showed a clear understanding of the faith and lived a reputable life. He insisted, he claimed that the church had the right to excommunicate, to bar from the Lord's table those whom it deemed immoral or undisciplined. And that was something new and something unpalatable to the citizens of Geneva. There were fierce debates, and Calvin didn't get his way. Then also some of the other Swiss cities interfered, and all the politics were very complicated. Anyway, it came to the point that the council, the town council of Geneva, ordered the ministers of the church to follow the rituals used in one or two other Swiss cities, to dress with the robes that their ministers used. Calvin and Farrell refused, I think on the principle that they weren't going to have unbiblical or neutral ceremonies imposed upon them. They refused to administer the Lord's Supper as long as this order of the council hung over them. And the council responded. You have the extract down there at the bottom of the third page, two extracts from the council meetings. They threw them out. Gave them 3 days to leave the town if they wouldn't accept the council's power. And Calvin and Farrell were expelled from Geneva. Geneva hadn't become Catholic again. No, it remained nominally Protestant. But they got ministers there who were prepared to do whatever the town council told them. Calvin went to Bâle, You can see in what sad and even bitter spirits saying that, you know, when nearly swept away by the river, we got more tender treatment from the river than we did from our fellow men. Calvin has, if you like, suffered defeat in his first efforts as a church organizer. And he's back to his books in Basel, but not for long. He's called to Strasbourg to be the pastor of a church of exiled Frenchmen. A whole group of French evangelicals, Protestants, have now fled to Strasbourg, and Calvin is called to be their pastor. He ministered there for some 3 years, a very fruitful interlude in his life. He developed in that little church of French Protestants, who of course were all sympathetic to him and in agreement with him, that was why they were there as exiles. He developed his ideas on the church's worship, the way the Lord's Supper should be celebrated, and the way the Lord's Supper should be disciplined. Still, there were problems, because in those days town councils thought they were the ones who should decide on who was to be excommunicated. But despite some problems in that way, his work in Strasbourg developed. He also got married in Strasbourg. You can see how romantic he was from the quotation on his letter to Farrell on what he was looking for in a good wife. And he married, in fact, the widow of an Anabaptist. And also, while he was in Strasbourg, he got involved in some of the big international conferences that were going on to try to settle the religious disputes. He travelled from Strasbourg to Worms, famous as the Diet of Worms in Germany, where Luther had made his bold stand some years before. There was a conference there in 1540. Went to another place called Ratisbon near Nuremberg the year afterwards, and was involved there in debates with Melanchthon and Bucer, some of the leading Roman Catholics. Calvin became well known, and he played a major part in the clear and firm stand that the Protestants took in these conferences, which of course failed to reunite the churches. But Calvin there was displaying and developing his wider concern for the church, something that we'll look at later on, and something that's expressed there on the last page in that letter to Bullinger. Finally, and I'm like all the other history books, I spent too long on the early parts, but in 1541, or we should say rather meanwhile, things had been in confusion in Geneva. Calvin had adopted a very commendable attitude. When he left, many of the people in Geneva, of course, were great friends of Calvin and great supporters of his. But he wrote to them most sternly and firmly, ordering them to support the new pastors, even though they were in many ways disreputable men, and even though they were being brought in to usurp Calvin's place. He ordered his friends not to divide the church, but to hold together with the church in Geneva. But the new pastors were pathetic men. The city of Geneva was rent by factions within the Protestant camp. And eventually they sank into such chaos that, you know, there were sort of political changes, and the people of Geneva asked Calvin to go back. He was anything but keen. Several months before he finally agreed to go, he said he would rather die a thousand deaths than go back to Geneva. And again, it took old Farrell with his stern and blunt dealings to drive Calvin back to Geneva. You can have that extract at the end there, his letter to Farrell, when he speaks about, look, he says, I found it hard enough pastoring this little congregation in Strasbourg, who were all basically sympathetic to me. You know, how can I cope with this church in Geneva, which has been such a pain in the neck to me before, you know? Actually, Calvin's letters, the banner do that little paperback selection of Calvin's letters, I think they're the most helpful way of getting the feel of the man, especially these letters to Farrell, because he and Farrow were close friends, and Farrow was absolutely blunt to Calvin, and Calvin was blunt back to Farrow. You know, sometimes if you read somebody's formal letters to a king or whatever, well, they're a bit stilted. But when Calvin wrote to Farrow, I think he just said what he really felt and put it down very bluntly. And that's a very interesting way of sort of getting inside the man's skin. Eventually, though, Calvin gave in and went back to Geneva in the late summer of 1541 and remained there as minister. I don't mean he never went outside the town, but he retained the post there as minister of the church in Geneva for the rest of his life. Well, we'll carry on with the story next week. Let me quickly just draw two lessons, and I'll just take a minute each on these. Firstly, you know, we should learn that behind all Calvin's writings and his life and his organisation of the church was a rich and dangerous and uncertain life. Because we don't have a detailed account of his conversion, maybe we think, you know, we fall into the trap of saying, oh, well, Calvin was just all intellect, logic. People love to say Calvinism is all